What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
With me on the line is Allison Stanger, and she is a professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College, and she's written this remarkable book. Talk about timeliness. It's called Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. And I do want to talk to you about what's going on in our country today. It's of such import. But I learned an awful lot in your book about whistleblowers, and I just didn't realize, I guess, that this is a uniquely American tradition that predates even our Constitution.
Absolutely. I write in the book that whistleblowing is in America's DNA. The first whistleblower protection law was passed in 1778, during the Revolutionary War and even before the Constitution was ratified. So this is a very important part of the American experience and American democracy.
And how did we recognize early on that we had these ideals of a nation that really was going to be fair and just, but in practice, things would not necessarily always be that?
Well, with American constitutional democracy, you always have the ideals and then the reality, and there's a gap between ideals and reality. The way I like to think about it is that whistleblowers help us to close that gap. By exposing inconvenient truths, they force us to really examine our blind spots and look at the world as it is and whether it's really congruent with the world we want to see. So American democracy really can't function without whistleblowers who, along with the First Amendment, help keep our elites honest.
Now, by virtue of you providing us with contrast, I think we can begin to shape and contour what a whistleblower is or what whistleblowing is. You say some may confuse it with political activism, but it's not that.
That's right. And this is a really interesting point to understand. I don't write about this in the book so much, but I'm writing about it in an article that will come out next week, that whistleblowing has positive connotations in the American context. Remember the debates over Edward Snowden?
The biggest controversies
were over, is he a whistleblower, is he not a whistleblower? And that's because we take whistleblowing really seriously. It's an important way of keeping American democracy on track. In other countries, it's fascinating. You find, for example, in Europe, that in most European countries, the word whistleblower has negative connotations. And the reason that is, especially in post-communist Europe, if you come from a regime that doesn't respect individual rights and promote civil liberties and freedom, someone who informs is a snitch because they're getting someone in trouble. Whereas in a democracy, whistleblowing is seen very differently. It's holding elites accountable. It's connected to the rule of law and self-government. So I find it fascinating the sorts of defenses that the president is using in this most recent conflict, because they sound a lot like what you would hear in an authoritarian regime, not in an American democracy with a 200-plus-year tradition.
And we will get back to that and plumb that pretty deeply.
Sure.
You also tell us that they are unlike civil disobedience. Explain that. I mean, the whistleblower versus somebody who's involved in civil disobedience.
Yeah, it's really important, because when you see the word term whistleblower used, it's often misused. And I wrote the book in part to get us to think about it as something rooted in the rule of law, that whistleblowers expose misconduct, oftentimes the misuse of public power for private gain, and they expose law breaking and even unconstitutional behavior. So it's not a partisan issue, although there are politicians who want to paint it as such. Properly understood, it's really an American issue. It's patriotic to report misconduct when you see it. But civil disobedience, in contrast, that is exposing laws that are unjust. So a civil disobedient is breaking the law in order to highlight that that rule is unjust. So when Rosa Parks, for example, moves to the front of the bus, she's breaking the law, but she's doing so to show us that the law is inconsistent with our Constitution. So that's very different from a whistleblower. A whistleblower is an insider who has information and reveals it, and it's usually information that elites don't want revealed.
Exactly. And let's get back to the point about leakers, because we've heard a lot about leakers lately. I mean, even James Comey was considered by some within the Trump administration to be a leaker. And then Edward Snowden is probably the greatest example of that, of late.
Sure. Yeah. Well, this is the thing. There's all sorts of forms of whistleblowing, and there's actually a second case with respect to the president about his tax returns. That's currently with House Ways and Means. National security whistleblowing, which is what would have to do with Snowden and with Comey, is really the most fraught area, precisely because in order to blow the whistle, you often have to go outside the organization to expose the information. The reason being that the intelligence community doesn't like leaks. They're leaking a lot now, but they're behaving in an unconventional fashion. And basically, a national security whistleblower has to break the law by revealing classified information in order to uphold the rule of law for a higher purpose. So it's not something that's done lightly, and the intelligence community typically does not leak, precisely because, you know, it could be the most innocuous piece of information that might just be that missing jigsaw puzzle piece in someone else's larger puzzle. So that's why the tendency is to classify and to keep all that information close to the vest.
Obviously, well, of course, just today as we're speaking, this issue has come up again, even in the hearing with the Director of National Intelligence, patriotism versus treason. And, some say, well, you know, you're not a patriot, you're a treasonist in what you're doing because you're revealing American secrets. And you remind us that subsequent to 9/11, these things became more guarded and more secret perhaps than ever.
Yeah, the thing that's curious about the United States is we have this robust whistleblower tradition, but ever since World War II, and particularly after 9/11, we have developed this enormous national security state. Its budget is immense, and it has tremendous power. And so it becomes really important to review what it's doing. But since everything has to be kept secret, how do you really review what it's doing? That's why the intelligence community set up the Inspector General precisely for this purpose, to have a place internally that you could report misconduct. It could be vetted inside the organization rather than having you go to the press. And then the idea is that the Inspector General is supposed to decide whether that's worth passing on to Congress. So passing it on to Congress is a very big deal. But it's interesting because with the case of Snowden, he really broke the law in order to reveal something that the American people needed to know about, that we needed to have a public discussion about. So on the one hand, he's a traitor, because he leaked this classified information, which in some ways can help our enemies. On the other hand, he provided a public service by showing us that the emergency measures that went into place after 9/11 at the NSA had become business as usual. Yeah, no, after being attacked, you might take emergency measures. But what had happened was they just became business as usual. But nobody knew that. And that's what Snowden exposed, and we had a public discussion, and the law changed as a result.
And when you do look at whistleblowers in the context of the fractured political environment that we're in, and particularly in this case, of course, when you've got the President of the United States questioning the motivations of the individual who has come forward, even at the same time as he's saying he doesn't know who that individual is. And I was just reading an account that said there's a sense that there's an indicia of political taint on this individual. How do we know that? Who is saying that? And how dangerous is that to the entire concept of whistleblowing?
Well, it's terribly dangerous. It really provides a chilling effect. It's saying there is no such thing as national security whistleblowing. You're not allowed to point out things you think are wrong. And that's inconsistent with democracy and with self-government. We don't want that sort of system. You have to realize, and in my book really shows this, that the intelligence community doesn't leak like this. It's very unusual behavior. So it's an indication of being in an extraordinary situation where they have sworn an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the United States. And to uphold that oath, they feel like they have to blow the whistle or leak information. And that's an unprecedented state of affairs.
Absolutely. Let's just go back before we delve again into the topic that is on everyone's mind today. And let's look at the laws that protect whistleblowers. And of course, we've seen lots of changes in those laws. And in the recent period, we've had adaptations of law. And then, of course, there is a special directive that relates to intelligence community and such. So just walk us through what the basic protections are for whistleblowers.
Sure, and I give you this in much fuller detail in the book, so I'll keep it really brief here.
Of course.
Basically, what you need to understand is that in the national security realm, national security whistleblowers currently have no statutory protection. In other words, the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act of 1989, which was revised in 2012, explicitly excludes anybody who works in the national security field from whistleblower protection for the reasons we've just talked about, right? That you know, you've got to keep the information secret. It's important for national security. These are legitimate reasons. But because that didn't sit well with President Obama, he issued a presidential policy directive that set up the Office of the Intelligence Community Inspector General. So it's an executive order.
So that's Mr. McKenzie who we're hearing about.
Yeah, exactly. So that's there, and that's an attempt, even though the statute says national security whistleblowers are excluded, it's an attempt to have some mechanism, some means for these sorts of abuses to come to light. But what you need to understand is how perilous it is. And you can see it right now in the rhetoric the president is using for a member of the intelligence community to blow the whistle, because there's also a program right alongside that intelligence community inspector general that's called the Insider Threat Program, which is designed to try to detect the future Edward Snowdens. So we should not take lightly the courage of these people who are coming forward, and apparently there are more than one of them.
Alison Stanger is with us. She's just written a most timely book that has a historical sweep about the issue that she defines in one word, whistleblowers, honesty in America from Washington to Trump. You said a number of things that surprised me in the book. One, that federal employees today are more likely to report corruption, yet more vulnerable to retaliation. So when I keep reading about these adaptations in the law that are meant to make certain that we have more transparency and honesty, I mean, as we go along, we try to be more just and make certain that we root out things that are unconscionable. Why is it that, in fact, they're more vulnerable to retaliation today?
Well, this is what I call, it's a great question, this is what I call the paradox of whistleblowing. In my book, and I give you lots of examples of it, where we celebrate these ideals in theory, but in practice, whistleblowers pay a great price for what they do. It's an act of conscience that actually helps keep democracy vital and alive, but they usually lose their jobs, they lose their livelihood, they're called traitors, spies, turncoats, because they're the person in the crowd who's looking around and says the emperor has no clothes. You know, they're going against what society says is acceptable, and they say, no, that's not acceptable. And so they often suffer greatly for their courage, and I think we really need to keep that in mind in our present moment and think long and hard about whistleblower protection and making sure these people who have come forward are treated fairly and are not subject to retaliation.
Having said that, reading in your book that only 5 to 20% of federal whistleblowers have their assertions believed, and that, for example, in the case of OSHA, so we're not talking about national security, we're talking about safety in the workplace, they dismissed 54% of whistleblower claims. Now, we're told that generally you can believe it's truthfulness that's coming. Why would one take the risks that they are if it wasn't because they were just so pent up about an injustice or a concern? So explain that to us. It seems so contradictory.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because whistleblowers have a variety of motives, and I intentionally don't try to assess motives. As part of my definition of whistleblowing, I want to look at whether the law was violated or misconduct was revealed.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you get into motives, it's really tricky to sort out. And sometimes people come forward because they're angry. You know, they have the wrong sort of – what they're exposing really isn't wrongdoing. And then the case has to be dismissed. So every whistleblower complaint doesn't automatically make someone a whistleblower. That said, I think the system is – set up pretty strongly to put a high bar in place for a whistleblower complaint to be considered valid and a reward to be given. So I think that's what you're seeing in those numbers.
And do we find that there are more cases in public agencies, federal government, versus the private sector? I know Sarbanes-Oxley Act added protections for employees of publicly traded companies, but do we see more activity in the public or the private sector?
Well, this is an interesting question. You know, I intentionally, in this book really took me a long time to write. It took me 7 years, and I went through 5 full manuscript iterations, and I had hundreds of pages on the cutting room floor. I mean, and basically, I had originally included a lot of corporate cases in pharmaceuticals, but also financial fraud. I had some great interviews. I've got great material. It's all – that's not in the book. The reason I took it out of the book is I wanted to focus it on public servants and government, because I think they're two separate realms, although some of the issues are the same. In the private sector, in good organizations, that, you know, you are smart to have robust – whistleblower protection system in place so people can file complaints. You can examine whether they're justified, whether they require remedial action and change, and do that all inside the company, because that's going to save you from making some big Enron-like or WorldCom mistakes. So smart companies will take whistleblowing very seriously. And indeed, I think on balance, what you see is that the protocols are much more well-developed in the private sector than they are in government, and there are even cash rewards under Dodd-Frank that provided additional incentives for someone to come forward, because, again, you could be ostracized for being someone who just doesn't quite play with the team, and those financial rewards ensure that someone who comes forward and speaks truth to power won't be deprived of a livelihood in the future.
What's the best case scenario when somebody does whistleblow within the federal government? Obviously, there's not a cash reward, I don't believe. I mean, if they do really state their case, if they're believed and some action is taken in response to some of the actions they consider to be unjust or unfair or unlawful, what's the best that happens to someone who is justified in what they do and it's then upheld by the system?
Well, in the corporate sector, you can get an enormous financial reward. In the public sector, you're really just doing it because you believe in democracy. And you,
so that's it.
Yeah, no, I
don't mean that.
It's really – that's what it's amazing why they do it, because they are people who have committed their life to public service. This is true for employees at the State Department, the Department of Defense, anywhere in the U.S. government. And – you know, they feel right now that the commitment they've made is almost being mocked. And they thought they were working to support certain values that are being overturned. And that's what creates this incredible present moment where you're seeing so much whistleblowing. It's an indication of a system that's gone off the rails that we need to get back on track.
So that is the trend that we're seeing. We are seeing, you said, stories about whistleblowers increasing dramatically since the 1970s.
Yes, yes, definitely. I mean, it's particularly Daniel Ellsberg is the big turning point.
Mm.
The and also a man named Ernest Fitzgerald, whom I write about at the Department of Defense. It's grown in usage in articles. It's become a term that now has greater salience, and we're seeing it its ultimate destination in the events unfolding before us today.
Well, that's where we are. And we're here on the day when the DNI went in front of Congress. So we're going to be posting this podcast within days. But let me just read to you from one of the congressmen in my home state. Failing to protect the integrity of the intelligence community's whistleblower process will chill future whistleblowers from coming forward through proper channels to relay important information. So when we see what's happening today, and we haven't seen the president in full regalia on this, but we did see him today using the term spy, suggesting that in the past someone might have been put to death for this. Where are we headed, as best you can tell, in this entire process, and what will the likely impact be on the future of people coming forward?
Well, that depends on what Congress does, and I think we're at a real turning point where we have, it looks like, pretty clear-cut information that the president is using his office, in this particular Ukraine instance, his public office for private gain, and that's unconstitutional. We also have a complete subversion of the normal foreign policy process, foreign policy that the State Department has formulated and is implementing and monitoring. It is being end-run by the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. That's unprecedented. I'm not even sure Rudy Giuliani has a security clearance. Normally, people who are involved in the high matters of national security have security clearances. So that would be a question I'd want answered. Does Rudy Giuliani have a security clearance? And then you have this spectacle of the president and his personal lawyer and the attorney general of the United States collaborating in helping a foreign leader dig up dirt on the president's political opponent. That, too, is unprecedented because the Attorney General of the United States is not the president's personal consigliere. He is the person in charge of enforcing the rule of law and making sure that impartial justice is possible. So all of this is unprecedented. I think you're seeing a reaction from people who have committed their life to public service. They're coming forward and saying enough is enough.
When you heard the testimony this morning about why the Director of National Intelligence held off, why he went to the Office of Legal Affairs within the Justice Department, why he went to the White House in terms of executive privilege, if you were the whistleblower looking on and listening to this, even though the Inspector General made certain that he called it urgent and that it should be sent to Congress, and ultimately it has gotten to Congress, what is the thought process in your mind as to the whistleblower saying, wait a minute, why did you go to the foxes who, you know, really shouldn't be in the hen house?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an unprecedented situation on every conceivable dimension, because the thing that's important to keep in mind is that both the Inspector General of the intelligence community and the acting Director of National Intelligence, he'd only been on the job a month, he was appointed in August, are appointed by Trump. So these aren't people who are career public servants. They're Trump appointees. And yet they are going forward with this whistleblower complaint because they think it's serious enough that the American people should know about it and Congress should investigate. That's very significant to me because it is someone that Trump appointed. And part of the reason we see this revolving door of appointments is it's much, much easier to control the policy process and make it run exclusively out of the White House or out of Rudy Giuliani's briefcase when people are all acting, when it's pretty clear that if you part ways, if you disagree with the president, you will lose your job. And all of that is not typically the way we see American foreign policy made. Usually, in my class on American foreign policy, for example, I teach this seminar called Crisis Diplomacy, where we model National Security Council meetings. And the standard model is you want to have a robust debate with people disagreeing, and then you arrive at a policy consensus, and then everybody closes ranks, gets behind the policy, and it becomes the policy of the United States. Here you have something entirely different, where the policy is one thing. You know, we have systems in place for fighting corruption in Ukraine, for military assistance, and the president is using his personal lawyer to make the policy something else. So all of that is unprecedented, especially since it involves potential interference in our elections, foreign interference.
The latest reporting suggests that it is a CIA operative that we're talking about. How unusual is it for a whistleblowing complaint to come through but secondhand, meaning that this material was gathered and gleaned from people in the inner circle of the White House who might have access to this, and that's a small number of people, but he did not witness this himself? How unusual is that?
Well, I think that's, again, unusual, but I think it's part and parcel of this unusual situation in which we find ourselves, where in my book I argue, and you can see it all spelled out if you read it, that the American intelligence community has been blowing the whistle on Donald Trump for his failure to uphold his oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, and they have been doing that since the beginning of his tenure in power. So it's not as though this one person is doing something unusual. There have been many examples of the intelligence community leaking information. Again, they don't normally behave that way because it is so alarming.
Right, but they haven't come out as whistleblowers per se.
No, they have not. There's been a lot of leaking, and you know, James Comey, for example, who was a whistleblower in his own way, shared the information, his personal memos, with the New York Times. But this is really
through a third party. Yeah, it's gotten us so twisted in our thinking about a lot of this. You tell us the trends show that more people are taking risks that whistleblowing entails, but they're doing so in a system. All right, this is the system that was set up to honor an American tradition that doesn't protect them. So, I mean, are they not protected? I mean, these laws that we're talking about, 89, 12, 2012, I mean, what do they really do then?
Well, they're good laws. It doesn't mean they can't be improved. So one of the things I show in my book is how you have these really rough moments in American history, say during the first Gilded Age, for example, where Congress legislates to, in a sense, right the ship of state and get American democracy back on course. So I think what we're seeing right now is a situation where we clearly need better whistleblower protections. There's more we could do in this area, and it's Congress's job to do that. But first, we've got to deal with this clear and present danger.
What about the clarity as to how to report? When we heard the DNI today having to defend the decisions that he made, and you heard congressmen, particularly Adam Schiff, saying, you shall report this within 7 days to Congress. What do you think that does to really saying, oh, we really do have a process in place, and if I come forward with something, I know that it's going to get into the right hands, or at least the hands I intended to get into?
Yeah, and that's, again, I have numerous stories in my book where things go awry. I think the most promising thing in the current situation is that you had a unanimous support in the Senate for this whistleblower complaint coming forward. And that really reflects, again, how American this is. We are for whistleblowers. We don't want our elites to be corrupt. We don't want our president to be corrupt. And so now the process is underway, and hopefully it will reach its proper conclusion.
Can you give us just a little primer into this inspector general office that we've got within agencies throughout the federal government and their importance in all of this?
Yes, they're set up to ensure accountability of government and ensure the integrity of government. They're very important, and they too could be revitalized in response to this crisis we're now in. So there's work to be done, but thank God we have them.
When I go back to the paradoxes that you talk about in your book, you say whistleblowers first are commended, and then they are persecuted when media attention wanes. So obviously today you've got a lot of media attention on the issue at hand, the clear and present dangers, you call it. And so what happens when all of this dies down? Is it dependent upon the outcome in this case?
Oh, it's very much dependent upon the outcome. I think we just need to watch out for these whistleblowers, whatever the outcome is. Let's not forget about them, and let's learn from this situation and legislate to prevent the abuses we've seen. There's all sorts of ways that can be done. It can be a collective bipartisan effort. This is not a partisan issue. That's the most important thing I would want to leave with your listeners, is that this is not a partisan issue. It's a patriotic one. And American democracy and self-government depend on us having honest elites. They depend on us having a clear line between fact and fiction, because you can't have a democracy when the truth is just a matter of whatever the leader says it is. Self-government can't function under those circumstances.
Would you briefly tell us how the internet and internet surveillance have affected the work of whistleblowers?
Well, that I'm very much interested in my next book, but in this book, I interview the entire senior leadership of the NSA at the time of the Snowden leaks, and also Edward Snowden and a number of other NSA whistleblowers. So that's a really fascinating story to read about, and I will tantalize you with a promise that there's some good material at the end of the book. And that the last chapter about the Trump administration, if you notice, is written in the past tense.
the book is called Whistleblowers. Well, she does tell us that after Donald Trump, and we don't know when that is, Congress should end all warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens. So for those who aren't paying attention and haven't had somebody knock on their door, that's still going on.
No, because we had some revisions of the law in the Patriot Act, thanks to Snowden. That's not to say there aren't more revisions that could be made, but we're in the process of sorting that out. That's a work in progress.
But okay, Snowden, that's a work in progress. Them. You also suggest we should pardon Edward Snowden. Would you make a case for that?
Well, I argue in the book that he'll one day be seen as our first traitor patriot. In light of the extraordinary circumstances we're in, I thought it could be a great symbolic act to pardon him as a way of resetting the system, so that we don't see this extraordinary leaking on the part of the intelligence community, and we also don't see this deviation from norms on the part of the White House. So one way you could sort of make a fresh start would be to pardon Edward Snowden and work on these reforms that I've suggested.
Now, you also say, and this is really important in closing, that whistleblower protection should be extended in the realm of security. And of course, you know, we're watching play out in real time somebody who's in that security apparatus going through the process. And so how vulnerable is that individual given the level or the diminished level of protection that is allowed in these sensitive areas?
Well, once you have Congress on board with saying the complaint should come forward, then you're in a much safer realm than when Congress is not paying attention. So that's a positive sign. It's when the news isn't splashed all over the front page of the newspaper that and people aren't paying attention, that whistleblowers pay a price.
Yeah.
So hopefully we'll see the courage celebrated in this instance.
So whistleblower protection could become, in this case and going forward, a bipartisan issue. Perhaps that'll be the legacy of the Trump administration, that it gave more teeth to all that you're concerned about, I'm concerned about, and many Americans. Is that a possibility?
That would be a very positive outcome, that we could make our democracy stronger as a result of some of the tough circumstances we've been through. That would be my hope, and that it would be a bipartisan initiative.
Alison Stanger, thank you so much for being with us on America Trends, Whistleblowers, Honesty in America, from Washington to Trump. It's kind of hard to say both those names in the same sentence, but anyway, I thank you so much for coming by today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Larry. Have a good day.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com.